This is May 6th, 2018. I'm going to read and discuss articles about extremes. I guess that would be a good way to sum it up. Binging in many forms, not just food, and other extremes. I'm going to start by reading just some parts of an article that appeared in the New York Times by Frank Bruni, one of my favorite columnists, great writer. And this is actually from 5 years ago, but I think it's gotten more extreme. The phenomenon that he's talking about has gotten more extreme since then. Talks about binging on Netflix series. I have to skip over it. Some of the most entertaining parts of it, just in the interest of time. Let's pick it up here. Moderation. Remember that? It was once held up as an indisputable virtue, virtually synonymous with prudence. Don't get too carried away with any one thing. Don't become too set in your ways. That was the message from parents and teachers. That was the cue the culture gave. But America these days is an immoderate land of fixed opinions and outsized fixations. More and more we wallow in our established political philosophy, in our preferred interest group, in our pastime of choice, in whichever health routine we've turned into a health religion. I did a Taisho, it just occurred to me, I did a Taisho maybe 20 years ago on a phenomenon called orthorexia, which means basically the idea that there is one right way of eating, one diet or cluster of similar diets that's right and the others are wrong. we're immoderate, not he goes on and outlines different things that 5 years ago seemed extreme with Fox News and other and extreme websites and I mean, very strongly partisan websites. He says, we're immoderate, not just in our affiliations, but also in our impulses. Work out so hard you vomit, proclaimed a headline on Slate.com not so long ago. The story with it presented a tour through the long, grueling trials to which the fitness intent subject to which the fitness intent subject themselves. Never mind studies that suggest that moderate exertion, less than 20 miles of running a week, not more, and at a stately pace, bodes best for well-being. A growing group of people want the more extreme experience of military-style boot camps and obstacle courses like those in the Tough Mudder program, whose adherents forego the treadmill and its individual TV screen for the exhilaration of crawling under barbed wire and swerving around flames. Bye-bye, Jack LaLanne. Hello, Full Metal Jacket. He mentions extreme campaign spending, which was nothing when he wrote this article compared to what it is now, has contributed to extreme partisanship. The left seeing little merit or valor in just about anyone on the right seeing the whole world with a tunnel vision that's extremely eerie, the deficit of comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, goodwill, the deficit of comity has led to the imminent spending cuts known as sequestration, which is an extreme answer to Congress's failure to agree on a course of moderation. And then more on much more recent article, although I can't find the date of this. This is also from the New York Times by Kate Murphy, a journalist in Houston. And it's called Why People Love to Jump Off Cliffs. She starts out, what do you do to unwind? Watch Netflix, bike, hike, golf, go for a run, dine out with friends, garden, dance, read. But for some, it's not recreation unless they're risking their lives. Participation in so-called high-risk, extreme, or adventure sports has grown significantly in the last decade. Whether they're big wave surfing, mountaineering, desert running, base jumping, or free diving, more people are chasing an adrenaline high and sometimes dying in the process. Psychologists, sociologists, anthropologists, and neuroscientists say the motivation is not a death wish, but rather a yearning to feel alive, which reveals much about us as a society. There's more to this that I'll comment on a little bit later after reading more of this. Not a death wish, but a yearning to feel alive. Of course, it is more of that than a death wish. And then she quotes an Oren Starn, a professor of cultural anthropology and history at Duke University. We are living in a virtual, confused, hyper-technological, postmodern world where we're all looking for real experiences. It's a continuum of hipsters buying land to farm organic blueberries, to musicians wanting to play original pre-jazz, old-time music, to now maybe getting out on Glacier and trying to climb it. And then she cites statistics about sales of extreme sports gear, climbing ropes and rigging, crampons, wingsuits. Wingsuits, she tells us, are like jumpsuits with fabric flaps that make the wearer look like a flying squirrel. Wingsuits and parachutes report significant sales growth over the last 5 to 10 years. Travel bookings to the world's premier jumping, diving, surfing, and climbing destinations in Europe, Australia, elsewhere. Mount Everest has become something of a trash heap as hordes of climbers have been less than fastidious in their ascents. And then, of course, there are the estimated 200 or so frozen bodies of those who didn't make it. Notably, she says, the popularity of extreme sports is happening as participation in tamer traditional sports like golf, basketball, baseball, and football has been declining. She says a certain market analysis says participation in extreme sports has surpassed conventional sports. There are no rules or penalty flags on a rock face or in the barrel of massive wave. You do it right or you die. It requires maximum focus, and here we're getting into the Zen part of this, maximum focus, and at least for a little while, erases all other concerns. Therein, perhaps, lies the appeal. And then she quotes a guy from Florida who reports, you are 100% in the moment, hyper aware of everything and focused on just that job and nothing else, he says. And this guy has an almost full-time leisure pursuit, which is wingsuit proximity flying, which involves jumping off things like mountains and cell phone towers and gliding perilously close to the surrounding terrain before deploying a parachute. And then he goes on to say, it's addictive, that feeling of fear and the reward when you control the fear. and land safe. And then you want to go up, like, right away and do it again. So this gets to the heart of the appeal of it, I think. It's not a death wish. If anything, it's a misguided attempt to overcome one's fear of death. That's what came to me many years after my own skydiving experience, my one and only skydiving experience, which at the time I just thought was just, you know, great, fun, and so forth. And only later, after doing a few sessions, that I realized that I was just trying to conquer a fear of death. But beyond that, this about being hyper-aware, focused, this really is their only access to this realm of no mind that we can train ourselves to reach in all of our activities. This is what puts Zen practice and other meditations, it puts it above all of these things, a different realm. Because why do these what are they called, proximity flyers or skydivers, why do they have to go up and do it again? Because they depend on that specific activity to lose themselves. Losing oneself means losing the thought of self, losing self-consciousness. That's what we're doing all the time, and we're training ourselves in daily zazen, and it has to be daily if it's real training. We're training ourselves to detach from thoughts, the thoughts that cause us so much low grade and worse misery, such as self-consciousness. You're free. When you're in that state, it demands such attention, these extreme sports, that you can't indulge in thoughts. You have to be free of thoughts, and that's the joy of it, really. But they haven't learned that there's a way that we can bring that to everything, and so they keep they're enslaved by it in a way. Keep going back to it and back to it. This is the realm of no thought that we can integrate into our daily lives, the most ordinary things, commuting, washing the dishes, mowing the lawn. To a degree, of course, these activities don't demand the kind of attention that these extreme sports do. But still, little by little, over the years, we can lose ourselves in the most ordinary things that most people would consider drudgery and boring. And the fear, it's addictive. Again, that feeling of fear and the reward when you control the fear. Fear of death. That's the big one. I mean, the surveys say that it's only second, the fear of death among fears. The first is fear of speaking in public. But I would submit that the fear of speaking in public is the fear of death. It's the fear of dying to your self-image. It's fear of failure. I'm skipping a couple paragraphs. She says, psychologists have tried to categorize people who take extreme physical risks, like skydivers and race car drivers, as being prone to sensation seeking, similar to people who abuse drugs and gamble compulsively. Researchers have variously attributed this to psychopathology, a genetic quirk, or possibly a chemical imbalance. for instance, low levels of the feel-good neurotransmitter dopamine. But none of these explanations is likely the whole story. Yeah, so each of those might be a thread in this, but not the whole story. She says, and while the research is slim and lacking much scientific rigor, studies of extreme sports enthusiasts suggest they have diverse biologies, personalities, and backgrounds. There is no single profile that predicts engagement in extreme sports, said Dr. Eric Monasterio, a psychiatrist and clinical researcher at University of Otago in New Zealand, who is also an avid mountain climber. There are all sorts of paths to it. And here's another, this is, I think she really finds, other than she finds some good points to make here. She says, he and others who study extreme sports point to cultural, sociological, and even technological factors as the most likely explanations for the recent surge in participation. And then this Dr. Montesterio says, efforts to eliminate risk are an obsession in the Western world. We have to make playgrounds and public spaces perfectly safe, and there's all this litigation around physical and mental injuries in relation to all kinds of activities. That sterile environment is frustrating and makes people crave stimulation and excitement. I read some little thing recently that I think it was Sweden, the Scandinavian countries are usually out in front of most other countries. In Sweden now England, they are building playgrounds that are more risky, where kids are more susceptible to injury, because they recognize that without that, that's a way of developing self-confidence and a sense of mastery of the environment, not by trying to eliminate all risks, which is a silly idea anyway. It's the middle way. It's finding the balance, not too risky, but not entirely sterile or safe. The author here, Kate Murphy, says high-risk sports are also seen as a reaction against living life mediated through a mobile device rather than having real-life experiences. This Dr. Starn says, it's an escape from a social media-obsessed society where so much seems fake and contrived, and we're indoors so much that the idea of risk-taking in the outdoors is very appealing. Research by Welsh and French sports psychologists indicates individuals who have trouble identifying or expressing their feelings, which is essential to maintaining stable and supportive relationships, are drawn to high-risk sports because it presents them with a very recognizable and unambiguous emotion, fear. I think this, each one of these points is very, very on the mark. That was also I was so out of touch with my feelings as a college student that that's what it took. I remember it was the first time I'd ever had wet palms. Was going up in that little Cessna to take that jump. Second time was when I was landing in Detroit Metropolitan Airport, returning from a time in Europe when I had about $1,000 worth of hashish stuck in my camera around my neck. I thought, I'll never figure that out. And they didn't. Which set me up for the worst night of my life. A lot of this is male things, being out of touch with one's feelings, not being permitted to experience fear and trying to avoid it. Here's another professor of performance psychology, Tim Woodman, who says people feel good about themselves afterward because they have the sense that they have control over their emotions, like, I can conquer my fear. But then they have this urge they have this urge to go back again and again because their true underlying fear hasn't been dealt with. She finishes up here, although this largely subconscious fear most often has to do with relationships and intimacy, there is also the compounding unease these days about the state of the world. I think this is another good point. Political unrest and dysfunction, discord between races and between sexes, and the plight of the planet can also make people seek to externalize their internal fears by engaging in extreme sports. Says so-and-so. I won't keep cluttering this up with all these names. It's a way for people to burn away these worries about the world that occupy their minds. This is the same guy we mentioned earlier, Carlos Briseño, who continues proximity flying despite having lost several friends. It gives you this rush, and that rush makes you feel like you are alive and free, and the happiness in that moment makes you think, well, I don't mind if I don't have any more days of life, because what I just did, it was so good, I could die right now. What a shame that that we have to resort to these things instead of experiencing the same thing in Sesshin, truly. A much safer sport. where once you can get your footing and get through just the physical discomfort and gone to enough of them, you can enter this realm where you realize there is nothing else like it. Absolutely nothing else like it. One of my sisters told me after her first sesshin that halfway through, or maybe more than half, maybe day five or six, she said to herself, I realized that I've been waiting my whole life to go to sesshin. Another factor that neither of these authors has mentioned yet, which another one does, is just our American disposition. This is from an article from a magazine called First. I think it may be from a Toronto newspaper by Heather Havrileski. And she makes this point. Oh, it probably isn't a Trump. Maybe it is, but it's about Americans. CrossFitters. That's she spends a lot of time talking about the extreme nature of this program. Represents one wave of a fitness sea change in which well-to-do Americans abandon easy, convenient forms of exercise in favor of workouts grueling enough to resemble a kind of physical atonement. Very American fixation on extremes at play. More is always better. It's also this very American belief in self-improvement, which is, granted, has value, has real value to it, wanting to never accept our limits, but to push ourselves beyond our imagined limits. But there's so much self in self-improvement. It's so much about getting ahead, maybe getting ahead of others, But it's also, I think she makes a point that it says there's something about the Protestant ethic or Calvinism or whatever that stuff is. She says the whole notion of pushing your physical limits, popularized by early Nike ads, Navy SEAL mythos, and Lance Armstrong's cult of personality, has attained a religiosity that's as passionate as it is pervasive. The extreme version of anything is now widely assumed to be an improvement on the original, rather than a perverse amplification of it. And as with most of sports culture, there is no gray area. You win or you lose. You leave it all on the floor, or you shamefully skulk off the floor with extra gas in your tank. But our new religion has more than a little in common with the religions that brought our ancestors to America in the first place, like the idealists and extremists who founded this country. The modern zealots of exercise turn their backs on the indulgences of our culture, seeking solace in self-abnegation and suffering. Yeah, anytime you see an extreme, this is something that's kind of a law that has never failed me as a general principle, not without exceptions. Anytime we see an extreme, we have to infer its opposite, that it's some kind of compensation for its opposite. And arguably, the United States is one of the most hedonistic, pleasure-centered countries in the world. So we see the opposite then. This is the route to a better life, they tell us, gesturing at their sledgehammers and their kettlebells, their military drills and their dramatic reenactments of hard labor. And in these uncertain times, it doesn't sound so bad to be prepared for some coming disaster, or for an actual job doing hard labor, if our empire ever falls. This is another thread to this, is I think it's a measure of our prosperity, our affluence, and our relative ease as a culture, that we're drawn to these things. How many people who are fighting for survival in the world would be attracted to these things? Or even fighting just for financial survival? It's really something for the privileged among us to be able to do these things. And privilege doesn't necessarily mean really upper wealth, but privileged enough to be pretty secure in a middle class or higher status, where we don't have to worry about what the things that most people, and well, certainly in developing countries, have to worry about. I see this phenomenon of extreme sports and binging on entertainment and other things as ultimately a way of avoiding the fact of one's own non-being. Of course, people don't think of it this way. Most of the world believes in a self that is permanent, relatively permanent, and that continues on, unchanging, through one's life. But underneath that, underneath these kind of activities, I'm really convinced, is this insecurity about knowing at some level of the mind that there is no self, no permanent self, that emptiness is the nature of things, even just in terms of the evanescence of life, the evanescence of the world. Everything is in flux. Somehow, even people who never even heard of the word Zen I think maybe they intuit that there's nothing that can be held on to, nothing to secure us to a thing, to a self, or anything. And so I see all excesses, really, as this avoidance. Avoidance means to not void, that is, to evade the void. Eating, excessive eating, excessive interest in food. Frank Bruni goes into that quite a bit. All of the not just attachments, but addictions that are available to us these days. Attachment or addicted to reading, addicted to being addicted to work, addictions to pornography, addictions to, of course, alcohol and drugs, painkillers and other drugs. You can say an addiction in the case of obsessive compulsive disorder, addiction to precision or control. People who are compulsive about fast driving, which I suppose is more an adrenaline rush, addiction to shopping, addiction to the internet, addiction to screens, cell phones, smartphones, and other screens, addiction to the consumption of news, addiction to our opinions and views. This is all trying to fill the hole that we think this realm of no self is. Filling the hole with all these things, the perceived hole. You got to have an opinion. You have to have a whole raft of opinions and views. Otherwise, who are you? We chant in the Affirming Faith in Mind, just let those fond opinions go. Who has the security of identity, and in Zen that means the identity of no identity, no self, who has that security enough to be free of opinions? All of these things are unconscious, almost always unconscious efforts and futile efforts to reify the self, to imagine, to try to create, or try to substantiate this self that is truly, actually, no self. It's so poignant, in a way, the desperation, what we do to fill this hole, to try to gird this idea of a self. And then, of course, the big one for Zen practitioners is our addiction to our thoughts. And if you think you're addicted to your thoughts, just do a good long stretch of sitting time sometimes, and you sesshin or other forms, and you see how exceedingly attached we are to our thoughts. How, despite our efforts, our best efforts, we keep getting hooked on our thoughts. The experience of the Dharma teaches the middle way. The middle way can be interpreted along different axes, but the ones from the old texts is the middle way between being and non-being. I've read so many from so many sources that I don't know all the sutras of the Buddha, but so many sources say that the Buddha never said flat out, there is no self. What he said in so many words is that there's no permanent, fixed, unchanging self-entity. So to believe that there is just no self of any kind is what is in the old text is called nihilism. It's nothing at all. That's just half the truth. That's the side of non-being. But the other half is also half the truth and half false. That standing against nihilism is eternalism. That's the idea that there is this one unchanging entity we call I. That goes on through one's life and into one's next lifetime. This is the being. So eternalism versus nihilism, being versus non-being. What awakening reveals is that neither of these is true. Not this, not that. Well then, what is true? And not even that. A passage here from a book called Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart by Mark Epstein, MD. I guess he's a psychiatrist. And I just pulled out a page here where he's talking about this. In Western psychotherapy or psychoanalysis, the mistake of thinking that we have to remove a sense of emptiness. Granted, emptiness can be a dreary cause of despair, but he talks about the potential, how potent, in terms of spiritual growth, emptiness is. He says, Buddhism, as I was learning, sought to turn the Western experience of emptiness around. Don't be so afraid of it. You can never understand what the Buddhists mean if you are so afraid of your personal emptiness. And then he says, the problem with the Western experience of emptiness was that it was mixed with so much fear. I thought at once of a disturbing trend I had witnessed at the psychiatric hospital where I worked. The patients, I'm not going to read that, we don't have time, but I'll just say, in our zeal to eliminate the ghosts of our childhood, to nourish the empty places of emotional insufficiency, and to achieve that pinnacle of psychological development that the British psychoanalyst Winnicott called feeling real, we were treating feelings of emptiness as something that needed to be fixed and cured, and therefore losing the ground upon which we rest. Our aversion to emptiness is such that we have become expert at explaining it away, distancing ourselves from it, or assigning blame for its existence on the past or on the faults of others. We contaminate it with our personal histories and expect that it will disappear when we have resolved our personal problems. Thus, Western psychotherapists are trained to understand a report of emptiness as indicative of a deficiency in someone's emotional upbringing, a defect in character, a defense against overwhelming feelings of aggression, or as a stand-in for feelings of inadequacy. Since most of us share one or more of these traits, it becomes all too easy to pathologize a feeling that in Buddhism serves as a starting place for self-exploration. So don't deny feeling of emptiness, of meaninglessness, of not knowing, really. Don't deny it and don't run from it. Run into it That's what we're doing when we detach from thoughts, whether we're sitting or we're moving about in our daily lives. We are running toward this emptiness that is everything. It's all there. It's all here in this emptiness. It's just a matter of converting it, transmuting what is painful, would cause us suffering, into something that frees us. There was this article I read from where this Kate Murphy article where she quotes someone as saying that these extremes, and not just sports, but all the other extremes and addictions. It's more of the sports, and it's an escape from a media-obsessed society where we're indoors so much that the idea of risk-taking in the outdoors is very appealing. I have to read from a final article, since this is spring. This is from The New Yorker, called Shouts and... This is a column, a regular column, called Shouts and Murmurs. It's a humorous column, and it's called Just in Time for Spring. And it's about this aversion to direct experience, the direct experience that is the outdoors is laying before us every single day. And it's the idea here is that there's this platform called Going Outside, and it's in all caps. Throughout the article, it's in all caps. And this is by an Ellis Weiner. Introducing Going Outside, the astounding multi-purpose activity platform that will revolutionize the way you spend your time. Going Outside, all caps, is not a game or a program, not a device or an app, not a protocol or an operating system. Instead, it's a comprehensive experiential mode that lets you perceive and do things firsthand without any intervening media or technology. And then he touts all of the benefits of going outside. 1. It supports real-time experience through a seamless body-mind interface. By going outside, you'll rediscover the joy and satisfaction of actually doing something. To initiate actions, simply have your mind tell your body what to do and then do it. Example, Mary has one apple. You have zero apples. Mary says, hey, this apple is really good. You think, how can I have an apple too? By going outside, it's easy. Simply go to the market physically and buy an apple. Whoa. Result, you have an apple too. Worried about how your body will react to going outside? Don't be. All your normal functions, respiration, circulation, digestion, etc., continue as usual. Meanwhile, your own inboard, ear-based accelerometer enables you to assume any posture or orientation you wish. It's a snap to stand up, sit down, or lie down. If you want to lean against a wall, simply find a wall and lean against it. 2. Is completely hands-free. No keyboards, mice, controllers, touchpads, or joysticks. Use your hands as they were meant to be used, for doing things manually. Peeling potatoes, applauding, shooting baskets, scratching yourself. The possibilities are endless. 3. Delivers authentic 3D real motion video with no lag time or artifacts. Available colors encompass the entire spectrum to which human eyesight is sensitive. Blacks are pure. Shadows, textures, and reflections are beyond being exactly like what they are. They are what they are. Going outside also supports viewing visuals in a full range of orientations. For landscape mode, simply look straight ahead at a real landscape if you so choose. To see things to the left or the right, shift your eyes in their sockets or turn your head from side to side. For portrait mode, merely tilt your head 90 degrees in either direction and use your eyes normally. Vision correcting eyeglasses are not included, but widely available. 4. Delivers head-free surround sound. No headphones, earbuds, speakers, or soundbar arrays required. And yet, amazingly, you hear everything. Sound is supported over the entire audible spectrum via instantaneous audio transmission. As soon as a noise occurs and its sound waves are propagated to your head, you hear it with stunning realism with your ears. Plus, all sounds, noises, music, and human speech arrive with remarkable spatial location accuracy. When someone behind you says, "Hey, are you on drugs or what?" you'll hear the question actually coming from behind you. 5. Supports all known and all unknown smells. Some call it the missing sense. But once you start going outside, you'll revel in a world of scent that no workstation, media center, 3D movie, or smartphone can hope to match. Inhale through your nose. Smell that? That's a smell which you are experiencing in real time. 6. Stay with me here. 6. Enables complete interactivity with inanimate objects, animals, and nature. Nature is capitalized with a TM trademark next to it. Enjoy the texture of real grass, listen to authentic birds, or discover a flower that has grown up out of the earth. By going outside, you'll be astounded by the number and variety of things there are in the world. 7. Provides instantaneous feedback for physical movement in all three dimensions. Motion through a 3D environment through 3D environments is immediate, on demand, and entirely convincing. When you, quote, pick up stuff from the dry cleaners, you will literally be picking up stuff from the dry cleaners. To hold an object, simply reach out and grasp it with your hand. To transmit from location to location, merely walk, run, or otherwise travel from your point of origin toward your destination. Or take advantage of a wide variety of available supported transport devices. 8. Is fully scalable. You can interact with any number of people, from 1 to more than 6 billion, simply by going outside. How? Just go to a place where there are people and speak to them. But be careful, they may speak back to you. Or remain alone and talk to yourself. 9. Affords you the opportunity to experience completely actual weather. You'll know if it's hot or cold in your area because you'll feel hot or cold immediately after going outside. You'll think it's really raining when it rains because it is. Skip 10. 11. Provides access to everything not in your home, dorm room, or cubicle. Buildings, houses, shops, restaurants, bowling alleys, snack stands, and other facilities, as well as parks, benches, fountains, deserts, tundras, taigas, savannas, plains, rivers, velds, meadows, and all other features of the geophysical world, become startlingly and convincingly real when you go to them. Take part in actual sporting events, or observe them as a, quote, spectator. Walk across the street, dive into a lake, or jump on a trampoline surrounded by happy children. After going outside, you're limited not by your imagination, but by the rest of reality. It was also trademarked, reality. Millions of people have already tried going outside. Many of your friends, in quotes, may even be going outside right now. Why not join them and see what happens? And on that note, we'll stop and recite the four vows. Oh. beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind measure. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.